Iran criticizes the suspension of its voting right at the United Nations, blaming Washington's cruel sanctions for the situation. Meanwhile, Iran reiterates support for the government of Kazakhstan, condemning any foreign interference in the country. And the U.S. dollar falls to a two-month low after data shows a new 40-year rise in American consumer prices. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran has criticized the suspension of its right to vote at the United Nations, stressing U.S. sanctions have brought about the situation. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says Iran is a founding and active member of the UN and considers itself duty-bound to fully and timely pay its membership fee. Khatibzadeh stresses that Tehran has prepared the fees and is conducting necessary consultations to resolve the issue. He's also urged the UN to take the situation of sanctions-stricken countries into account. Iran has been denied the right to vote at the UN General Assembly after failing to pay its membership dues because of the sanctions. Political commentator Keaton Mansfield joined us earlier with his take on the story.
Well, you know, Iran has been involved, has been a member with the United Nations since its formation after World War II. And the UN is supposed to be an impartial international organization where all countries meet in a central location to address global political matters on a level playing field, where every person's vote, regardless of how powerful or how wealthy a country is, each vote should be worth the same amount. And so, because of the sanctions that the U.S. and international global financial institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, have levied against Iran, it's made it very difficult for the government to pay its, you know, its UN dues. And so if the UN isn't going to seriously take action to have the U.S. remove these sanctions, then the UN also can't pretend or claim that Iran has to listen to the UN. If Iran doesn't get a vote at the United Nations, then they can't be expected to be held accountable to the United Nations. And so I think it's a bigger issue of the UN needs to kind of buck up and stand up against the U.S. and the pressure that the U.S. has put on the UN General Assembly as a whole and the Security Council.
Iran's foreign minister has reiterated support for Kazakhstan's sovereignty and condemned any foreign interference in the Central Asian country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with his Kazakh counterpart, Mukhtar Tuliberdi. Top Iranian diplomats stressed on the need to boost bilateral ties. Tuliberdi, for his part, said that his country will continue its friendly policy with Iran. He also called for the development of bilateral trade. Central Asian nation recently witnessed deadly street protests sparked by a fuel price hike. Kazakh officials say law and order, though, has now been restored. 90 years ago, the University of Chicago in the U.S. borrowed tens of thousands of archaeological fragments discovered in Iran's ancient city of Persepolis for research. However, after nearly a century, and despite many official requests and a court ruling, Washington is still refusing to return them, using a variety of pretexts, but now Tehran is resolved to give back what is rightfully its possession.
These artifacts are just a few amongst the thousands of clay tablets discovered in an excavation in Iran's old city of Persepolis more than nine decades ago. Back then, American archaeologists borrowed the Persepolis collection for a period of 3 years for translation, research, and cataloging. Flash forward 90 years, and many of these ancient fragments are still at the Oriental Institute in the University of Chicago. At some points over the past decades, Washington even attempted to seize this collection of antiquities using its anti-Iran allegations. But in 2018, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Iran's ownership of these assets. Susan Cherokchi, a legal expert with Iran's Ministry of Cultural Heritage, says it is time for these artifacts to return home.
This is the year 2022. 4 years have passed since the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in favor of lifting the ban on these tablets. But the Persepolis tablets, the borrowed properties of the Iranian government and nation, have not returned home, except for a few of them. Still, the majority of these valuable artifacts are in the possession of the Oriental Institute, and logically, after 9 decades, they need to be sent back to Iran.
She has even disclosed some parts of the correspondence taking place between Iranian and American officials in 1934, based on which the American side agrees to return the inscribed tablets at its own expense. Another article requires the Chicago University's Oriental Institute to send copies of the works, reviews, and collections to Iran's then Ministry of Instruction. Promises never fulfilled. American experts themselves stress the significance of these antiquities for studying ancient Persian history.
These tablets are one of the most important sources for us about the Achaemenid dynasty at their peak.
Abdul-Majid Arfai, a distinguished Iranian expert of ancient languages, says these tablets reveal some remarkable information about the ruling period of Darius the Great.
One of the clay tablets reveal an order by Darius the Great to an assistant to give 100 of Darius's own sheep to a woman. Decoding this tablet reveals that all of the clay manuscripts belong to the era of Darius.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Tahkaravanchi, says Americans are using different excuses to postpone the return of what is part of Iran's culture and history. But Iran's request is clear, that what has been loaned must return completely, orderly, and safely. At the end of the day, these antiquities are nothing but the belongings of the Iranian nation and representatives of their long history.
Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal are underway in the Austrian capital in a bid to revive the agreement. Our Vienna-based correspondent, Homa Lesgi, says there are some positive signs that negotiations are moving forward. Here she is.
Today we heard that the third working group on implementation arrangements, or sequencing, also known as sequencing, between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA has also convened, which could be seen as a sign that progress is indeed being made, because up until this stage, sources were saying that the sides were not yet in a stage or ready to discuss this sequencing or implementation issues. The fact that this working group has met today on this issue is indeed itself a positive sign. And this, of course, when we're talking about implementation, we mean which actions need to be taken at what stages, that's what we mean by sequencing. The other two working groups, one is focused on sanctions removal and the other on the nuclear commitments of Iran. We also had, as you say, meetings today between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Barzani Kani, and the Europeans and the EU coordinator, and a meeting that was held between Russia and the U.S. envoy Rob Malley, and that meeting was described by Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian delegate, as positive. And he also said that there's a feeling that the talks are moving forward. Also positive signals coming from the Russian deputy foreign minister, Mr. Ryabkov, earlier. He was saying that the talks are gaining momentum. So we are hearing some positive signs there, although the French foreign minister said this doesn't mean we are near an agreement. He was insisting yet that we are still far from a deal, although he did acknowledge that things are moving forward. The Europeans have been quite adamant in their position that time is running out, and some Iranian sources have said that this is meant to put pressure on the Iranians or to try and gain concessions during these talks. Another source close to the Iranian negotiating team was saying yesterday that there have been certain attempts to, for instance, introduce new demands into the talks or to revise the understandings that have already been reached within the context of the talks to restore the JCPOA, without going into further details of what those demands could be.
The U.S. dollar slumps to a two-month low as the country is experiencing its biggest annual inflation jump in nearly 4 decades. U.S. dollar currency index, which tracks the greenback against 6 major currencies, was down 0.7% at 94.944. A Federal Reserve official says that U.S. inflation is too high and that the central bank will make the issue a priority. Meanwhile, the Labor Department is reporting that consumer price index surged at a 7% year-on-year pace in December. Economists believe rate will likely reach a peak by March. U.S. is also grappling with disruptions to supply chains, which have been worsened by a surge in COVID-19 cases. A year into the storming of the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump, new poll shows a majority of Americans believe the country's democracy is in danger of collapse. A study conducted by the Connecticut University says 76% of Americans think political instability in the U.S. is a bigger danger than foreign threats. Over half of them also expect domestic political divisions to worsen. The poll comes as a special committee of the House of Representatives is investigating last year's deadly insurrection. Storming was meant to overturn Trump's defeat in the 2020 presidential race. Now most of those surveyed say they support the investigation. North Korea's recent missile firings are drawing yet another angry response from the U.S. U.S. Treasury says it is imposing sanctions on the North over its weapons program. Sanctions target six North Koreans, a Russian individual, and a Russian firm. All have been accused of procuring goods from Russia and China for the North's weapons. Treasury says measures are aimed at preventing the advancement of such programs by Pyongyang. Sanctions are the first imposed by the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. North Korea has conducted six ballistic missile launches since September. U.N. Security Council resolutions that is banned such tests. Washington wants Pyongyang to sit down for talks to try to resolve differences, but Pyongyang says Washington must stop its hostile actions before any negotiations can take place. Meanwhile, Russia tells NATO that further deterioration of ties could lead to unpredictable consequences for European security. Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko says various NATO positions are unacceptable and the situation over Ukraine is becoming intolerable for Russia. Grushko is accusing Western military alliance of trying to contain his country and seeking to gain superiority in all areas. He says the Kremlin cannot take NATO's claims of peace seriously as its eastward expansion creates security risks for Russia. Separately, the Russian Deputy Defense Minister says that Moscow had offered de-escalation measures to the U.S.-led alliance that he said were ignored. Earlier, the bloc's chief warned of the risk of a new armed conflict in Europe. Jens Stoltenberg said that NATO could deploy troops to Eastern Europe if Moscow decides to use force against Ukraine. Earlier, we reached out to political analyst Garland Nixon for comments on Russia-West tensions. He believes U.S. and NATO will not be able to formulate and execute a coherent policy toward Russia.
I don't believe that the U.S. and NATO truly wants a military confrontation, but I don't believe that they are capable as a bloc, as an organization, of executing a policy that would make sense to the Russians and make sense to the world. So what does NATO want? What does the U.S. want? I'm not sure. You know, even as Joe Biden, as his team was ostensibly negotiating with the Russian diplomats back home, the U.S. Congress apparently has been preparing more sanctions. For what reason, I don't know. But so there's not enough continuity even within the context of the Biden administration to have a coherent foreign policy that could be executed by all that they all understand. It is a very dangerous situation for the Russians to clearly be concerned about their border security, which any major or minor country would have a significant amount of concern with.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is fighting for his political life after he was forced to apologize over his attendance at a Downing Street garden party in May of 2020 at a time when there was a nationwide lockdown due to COVID. It follows revelations of other Downing Street gatherings, which have angered those who say that the Prime Minister cannot simply flout the very rules that his government expects the rest of the country to follow. Amina Taylor reports.
It was a shocking U-turn for the British Prime Minister. After months and months of speculation, supposition, and denials, The weight of evidence regarding a Downing Street garden party held in May 2020 has forced Boris Johnson into an unfamiliar role, that of the contrite Premier.
I regret very much that we did not do things differently that evening, Mr. Speaker, as I've said, and I take responsibility and I apologise.
Leaders across the political divide slammed the Prime Minister's actions and urged him to step down.
After months of deceit and deception, yeah. The pathetic spectacle of a man who's run out of road. Yeah. His defence that he didn't realise he was at a party. It is so ridiculous that it's actually offensive to the British public. He's finally been forced to admit what everyone knew, that when the whole country was locked down, he was hosting boozy parties in Downing Street. Yes. Is he now going to do the decent thing and resign? Yes.
Public sacrifice at the same time the Prime Minister was partying with his staffers in the British sunshine has hit a nerve.
And I was told my stepmother was going to die. Luckily, she didn't, but I was told I wouldn't be able to attend the funeral in Scotland. That's minor. Other people have many worse stories than that. People have missed family funerals, have missed weddings, have missed all sorts of things because they have stuck with the rules which were agreed by Boris Johnson's government.
Often referred to as the Teflon Prime Minister because none of the scandals in which he's been front and centre have seemed to derail his premiership. But it seems now the activities behind the gated walls have even his most ardent supporters asking if Boris Johnson is still worth backing.
I think there's a shift, and I think it is because people could believe what they wanted over the renovation of the flat in Downing Street, over Boris's nuptial arrangements, his children, all of that. Lots of people just dismiss it. It's Boris. I think this is different because people's own experiences, visceral experiences during this pandemic, mean that they're putting up with this.
Johnson says he will await the findings of an independent inquiry into gatherings at his office during lockdown. But there are already growing calls from within his own Conservative Party for him to step aside, with some saying he has vastly underestimated the depth and strength of public anger. Amina Taylor, London.
That's a wrap for your news bulletin. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Guantanamo stands as a reminder of the enduring barbarism and savagery unleashed upon innocent Muslims by the Islamophobia generated in the West after 9/11, says Peter O'Born, journalist, in an article published under the heading Guantanamo, an enduring symbol of the savagery unleashed upon innocent Muslims. Stay tuned for more. 20 years ago, a Pakistani taxi driver called Ahmad Rabbani was kidnapped by Pakistani state authorities from his home in Karachi and taken to the country's capital, Islamabad. From there, he was transferred to Kabul, the notorious dark prison near Kabul in Afghanistan, where he was held in CIA custody. The Senate Select Committee report on torture, published 10 years ago, has documented what Rabbani and many others experienced. Kobalt's blackout windows left prisoners isolated in total darkness and often without heat in Afghanistan's freezing winters. They were shackled to bars with their hands forced above their heads, meaning they could never rest. Loud music was played constantly, denying sleep. Some detainees were subjected to cigarette burns. Others were stripped naked, hosed down with water, and placed in cold cells. Rabbani, 52, said that for days on end, he was hung by the hand to an iron shackle where my toes hardly touched the ground. This torture, known as estrapado, was favored by the Spanish Inquisition. After 540 days in Kabul, Rabbani was rendered to Guantanamo Bay, the offshore military prison where U.S. law does not apply, meaning that the U.S. regime was able to hold detainees indefinitely without charge as enemy combatants. Rabbani is innocent. As the Senate report recorded in 2012, he had been mistaken for an Al-Qaeda operative called Hassan Gul. The United States has known this for a decade, probably much longer. He is still in Guantanamo today. Many have suffered in the same way. In total, almost 800 men have been imprisoned during its 20-year history. Rabbani, a Rohingya Pakistani, weighed around 73 kilograms at the time of his arrest. Emaciated from a hunger strike, today he weighs just 30 kilograms, meaning he likes to joke that 57% of him escaped from Guantanamo. He suffers mentally and finds it hard to remember things. His family have been tortured too, but in a different way. In Islamabad last autumn, reporters met his 18-year-old son, Jawad. Jawad has never met his father, who was seized a few months before he was born. He told reporters how, as a child, his mother explained his father's absence by saying that Rabbani was away working in Saudi Arabia. He first spoke to him when he was 6 years old in a 15-minute telephone call arranged by the Red Cross. His father told him he was in jail. Jawad said, "I asked him, why are you in jail? The jail is supposed to be bad for bad people." He laughed and didn't reply. Jawad said this knowledge started to affect me a lot when he became a teenager. Jawad said, "I went to the dark web when I was 13 or 14 years old. So I looked for the videos, those people who tortured and how they torture and all the things you get on the dark web. I was in those groups where they used to share those videos where they tortured people and all those things. So I do have an idea of how they tortured him and all the things. Waterboarding, to kicking him, or playing music that will torture my dad. How they will make miserable his brain and all the things. I knew it. There was a time that I used to believe my father had committed a crime. That's why he has been tortured, because you don't torture a person for no reason. I used to cry, you know, at night in my room. Just imagine your life without your father for 18 years. what would you be? If he didn't touch you or care for you or provide you his love, his money, everything, where would you be? Jawad added. Jawad became introverted and tormented. He could never make friends because he felt unable to talk about his family circumstances. Jawad says the turning point came when he met Clive Stafford Smith, the British lawyer who has represented more than 80 of the Guantanamo detainees. Jawad said, "I learned after that meeting that my father is innocent. The second thing is that I shouldn't be ashamed of my father because he's in jail." It's a repellent story. The United States regime completely abandoned the rule of law and any pretense of due process with its practice of arbitrary detention and torture or enhanced interrogation. Britain complied meekly with the U.S. imprisoning and torturing British citizens without charge. British intelligence was involved in interrogations. Habeas corpus, that famed ancient liberty, which ensures that no one can be imprisoned unlawfully, has been completely disregarded in the war on terror. In the jingoistic post-9/11 atmosphere, Muslims were deemed by many in the West to be undeserving of basic human rights. It is inconceivable that the British government would have stood by as a white Christian Briton was tortured and imprisoned in Cuba. In the case of British Muslims, however, they considered it unproblematic. Every prisoner has been Muslim. The first 20 detainees arrived there 20 years ago, on January 11, 2002. Guantanamo constructs terrorism as a Muslim crime, requiring an alternative legal structure to cope with what was seen as the exceptional horror of Muslim crimes. The prison remains open today. Innocent men are sitting in their cells there at this very moment. The prison stands as a reminder of the enduring barbarism and savagery unleashed upon innocent Muslims by the Islamophobia generated in the West after 9/11.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين Dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته You are listening to IRIB English Radio Again, we are here to present with another episode of A Muslim Lady where we have been discussing so many important issues regarding Muslim Lady I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studios, my wife, Razia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Mr. Masumi, we all know that women are known to be very emotional, yeah? And that is one of the blessings of Allah, tabaraka wa ta'ala. It's really good. It's a blessing. But in some situation,
definitely they have to control, they have to limitize this beautiful blessing of Allah. So what are some ways, any tips to take control of emotion, how she can use this beautiful bounty of Allah in a right way?
When it comes to the emotions, because human being overall is emotional, yeah, generally speaking.
Exactly, yeah.
Men and women both, they are emotional. They express their emotions when they become happy, when they become upset, when they feel something, you know, very astonishing. So they show, they express their emotions, which is a very positive thing. But in some areas, expressing your emotions, showing your emotions is not good for your, you know, the tarbiyah of children, the relationship between you and your husband and your family members, or maybe the relations between the family or society members also. So we should know where we should express our emotions and where we should hide and control the emotions. For example, when it comes to the positive things between wife and husband, we have to express, appreciate, express our emotions. For example, if a husband buys a gift to his wife, wife should show the emotions, the appreciation, yeah? Vice versa, if wife does good thing, husband should appreciate and show the emotions. Likewise, to our children also, if our children do good things, they do their homeworks on time, so we should show the emotions toward them. Yeah, we should show them that we are happy, we are satisfied with them.
Expressions are very, very important, and it has also reward.
Yeah, it plays a very vital role in, you know, relationships, especially between wife and husband. As we say, whatever happens between you, if you express, Islam also emphasizes on this, expressing your love towards your wife.
We
have heard so many ahadiths from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So expressing our emotion is very important. But in some areas, we have to control our emotion.
You know why? I'm thinking that, you know, like the way you have water is a very big blessing and favor from Allah. But the same water, you know, we have to consume it in a limit, and we need it the way we need it. We have to use it. If it comes more than our need, then there's a flood. You know, this water can kill us. This water can just drown us. The same way emotions are beautiful, we need it. But when I'm becoming more emotional, then I'm using less my intellect. When I'm using less my intellect, maybe I'm talking more, nagging more, complaining more. Maybe I'm crying in a wrong place, you know, where I shouldn't use my tears. You know, the tears are very, very valuable. You know, I can use it in the way of Allah tabarak wa ta'ala when I'm having whisperings to Allah, when I'm praying namaz, not just for my, you know, little worldly desire. So I feel when I'm not controlling, when I'm just crossing the limits in using my emotions, I'm damaging myself, you know, because I'm the listener. I'm listening myself, you know. If I say something bad, if I'm talking a lot,
complaining a lot.
So that comes straight away to myself. Number one is
on
myself.
Yourself.
Exactly. Then automatically the others and the environment. Hadith, which says Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala has a beautiful place and a palace in Jannah, and which is a very outstanding palace inside the Jannah. So when Prophet asked that for whom this palace is,
So the reply was that it is for masjunun, like the people, they kept themselves in prison. Prison? Yeah, like I'm not prisoners. I will go to this palace in Jannah. What kind of prison? The prison means I'm keeping my tongue, my emotions, my desires, masjunun. I'm keeping my tongue in control and my stomach also, because, you know, we have that kind of shahwa to eat everything, to talk whatever comes in my mind. So this is kind of brake. You know, if your car has a brake, your brake is working, that means you are safe in the road. The same way, if your tongue is in your control, for example, and other desires, that means you are safe in your relationship between husband and wife. Yeah.
Speaking about the emotions, you know, we have a lot of emotions, so many kind of emotions like anger, happiness, or disappointment. So we can talk and speak a lot about these each and specific topic. So like, for example, controlling your anger. You know, in the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says so many times, والكاظمين الغيظ, the people who control their anger, they have a very high status in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So when it comes to control your emotions, first of all, the very bad quality all the human beings they have is anger. And anger destroys so many good relations. So we have to control this anger. And in controlling anger, it needs so many practical tips.
Yeah. And you know, because we are talking about the Muslim lady, I think because for ladies, this area is a very difficult zone to control their tongues, you know. Because when person is angry, most of the time he's using his tongue, he's talking. You know, less people, they just throw the things, you know, and just quiet. No. But when you are talking, and we as a women, we talk more, therefore, if we keep quiet, if we control our tongue, our reward would be higher, especially in using the tongue and emotions. And I would love to give some tips for women, especially I really want to fix the roots and the cause of anger. Yeah. Because, you know, I have to check myself, me as a wife, as a mother, yeah? When and how I get angry, that is the solution, that is the remedy. For example, I get angry when my kids, for example, they don't listen to me, yeah? So I have to reset my mindset. Why they have to listen to me? How much they have to listen to me? How much expectation I have from my kids? You know, sometimes I have more expectation. Sometimes they are in tired and angry mood and I'm having expectation from them. If I check the roots and the causes, I can easily, 90% maybe I can fix myself. And then the other wrong mindset is that I'm thinking that if my kids or my husband is, for example, listening to me in this era, then I'll be happy to them. Then I can do good to them. Otherwise, not. So my dealing is sharti, like with conditions. Like if, and that kind of if sometimes kill us. So it's so difficult to love them, to don't get angry, unconditional. So there's no any condition. Yeah, whatever they do,
almost impossible, especially nowadays.
Yeah, some great ulamas and some great people, they have done it. And we have to do it. Like, we can get upset from inside. And
we shouldn't show.
We are upset and we can ask Allah, Ya Allah, guide me and guide them. You know, that kind of anger is comes.
Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Uh, I love the way Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says, whenever you feel anger, just shut your mouth. And for every shutting your mouth and controlling your anger, you will get one gift from Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala.
As you said, you know, when we use our emotions, we use less our intellect, our brain. So it reminds me the beautiful saying of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says, "Man lam yamlik ghadabahu, lam yamlik aqlahu."
Beautiful.
Whoever cannot control his anger, he cannot control his intellect. Means he does not have the intellect and brain.
It's from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
Wow.
Yeah, beautiful hadith.
So I love him.
When we control our anger and control our emotions, then we can use our intellect more. And when we will use our intellect, definitely, then everything will be under control, under our control. Then we will not give more chances to destroy
I love this hadith. إِذَا تَمَّ الْأَقْلِ نَقَسَ الْكَلَامِ. If there's more aql, you're more intellectual, you speak less. One. And when you said this hadith, وَنْ لَمْ يَمْلِكْ غَضَبَهْ لَمْ يَمْلِكْ أَقْلَهْ. Yeah? أَقْلَهْ, yeah?
Yeah.
So at the same way, one more hadith, it says that if you don't have control on your tongue, then you cannot have control on the heart of the people, especially your husband, your kids. So we want to rule, you know, we want to be a queen and princess of the heart of our spouses or our children. We really want them to listen to us, but we are not listening to ourselves, like listening to our emotions. You know, I have to listen means control. If I'm controlling my tongue, my emotion, then I can control, you know, and have control of others' heart to
so
in my
the
head.
Main key in controlling your anger is controlling your tongue. It reminds me another hadith that, you know, if you speak less, means you will not have so many diseases. Diseases means our akhlaqi diseases, our
moral,
you know,
disease.
Moral problems. So this is a beautiful tip again to control your anger and control your tongue. So we can speak a lot about controlling your tongue, how you can control and what happens if you control your tongue. Yeah.
We were blessed with so many sayings of Masumin alayhi salam. Thank you so much, Mr. Masumi.
Thank you so much. Alhamdulillah. Each and every single hadith enlightens us. It gives so much noor in our hearts. I hope our dear listeners also enjoying these beautiful ahadith of Aimma alayhim as-salam as we both enjoy while discussing.
Alhamdulillah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The eagerness of the EU and UN bodies to defer to the Israeli regime is further indication that Palestinian human rights workers will be thrown to the wolves, says Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist, in an article titled West Throws Palestinian Rights Groups to the Wolves. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime's criminalization of Palestinians resisting foreign domination did not begin with the recent order declaring six prominent groups terror organizations. This dangerous development is only the logical outcome of decades of impunity and repression against any Palestinian assembly that challenges the Zionist regimes of apartheid, occupation, and colonization. One of the groups targeted by the Zionist regime War Minister Benny Gantz's terror designation order is Al-Hab, which was founded in 1979 and is one of the oldest Arab human rights organizations. Raja Shahada, one of the organization's founders, recounts in the New York Review of Books that the Zionist regime has persistently tried to discredit Al-Haq and his work. In his early years, this meant labeling Al-Haq a front for the Palestine Liberation Organization, which the Zionist regime outlawed before the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1990s. In 1980, the Zionist regime troops, suspicious of cars parked nearby, raided the group's offices during a meeting attended by an Amnesty International representative. Shahada stated in The Guardian recently, "When we lodged the complaint, the army began an interminable investigation of the incident, which after many years was still not concluded." It is but one example of the repression endured by Palestinians as all forms of collective organizing around their rights are treated by the Zionist regime as a security threat. Now, the Zionist regime is applying a draconian 2016 anti-terror law for the first time, accusing Al-Haq and five other groups of operating as covert arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance organization. That group is banned by the Zionist regime as well as the US and the EU because it refuses to go along with the Oslo Accords surrender, refuses to recognize the fake regime of Israel and renounce armed resistance. International law recognizes the legitimacy of armed struggle in anti-colonial and anti-occupation struggles against foreign domination. Criminalizing resistance groups like PFLP serves the oppressor. The Zionist regime has repeatedly jailed lawmaker and human rights defender Khalida Jarrar based on her membership with the PFLP without meaningful protest from Washington and Brussels. Governments have criminalized the Palestinian Movement for National Liberation by designating PFLP and other factions that reject normalization with their oppressor as terror organizations. Meanwhile, Palestinian human rights groups and other organizations have to divert resources from their core work to fulfill onerous auditing requirements to receive European funding. These conditions, first imposed by U.S. government agencies and private foundations, have increasingly restricted the work of Palestinian groups. Palestinian organizations must deal with funders' increased demands as the Zionist regime arrests their workers, raids their offices, and prevents staff from traveling abroad or between the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, the U.S. and EU lavish the Zionist regime with weapons and grants to develop repression technology field-tested on Palestinian bodies. The hypocrisy and double standards are mind-boggling. While banning Palestinian resistance groups, Washington flouts U.S. law that prohibits the government from assisting units of foreign militaries when there is credible information that those units violated human rights with impunity. Al-Haq leads the way in monitoring and documenting those human rights violations and advocating to burst the Zionist regime's bubble of impunity at the international level. Al-Haq and two other groups targeted by the Zionist regime's war ministry, Adamir and Defense for Children International Palestine, have filed evidence of war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Benny Gantz is likely being investigated by the court for his military chief and war ministry roles in 2014 and 2021 assaults on Gaza, during which the Zionist regime Air Force bombed civilian towers and obliterated entire families in their homes. As Al-Haq founder Raja Shahada observes, Gantz's terror group order is likely to be followed by one from the Zionist regime's military commander in the West Bank. That would mean that anyone working for any of the six targeted groups or providing services or expressing support for them will be subject to arrest on terrorist charges. Shahada adds, the organization's financial assets will be confiscated and the Israeli regime banks will stop any funding from reaching it. Barring significant international pressure on the Zionist regime, in 2 months, there won't be a Palestinian civil society, according to Obay Al-Aboudi, director of Bisson Center for Research and Development, one of the targeted groups. When the Zionist regime moves to starve Palestinian groups of the funding necessary to carry out their international advocacy work, its powerful international friends have sought to undermine accountability at The Hague. Their toothless statesmen of concern over the terror group designations must be understood in the context of their willingness to help the Zionist regime evade justice. It took Canada a week to acknowledge the Zionist regime's attack on the Palestinian groups while stating no position against it. In true settler state solidarity with the Zionist regime, Canada made thinly veiled threats to withdraw funding in a letter to the court stating its opposition to an ICC investigation in the West Bank and Gaza last year. Canada also paved the way for the siege on Gaza, now in its 15th year, by boycotting the elected Hamas government and cutting aid to the Palestinian Authority, citing the group's refusal to recognize the fake regime of Israel and give up Palestinians' right to armed resistance. Ottawa restored funding to the PA a year and a half later after the Western-backed Fatah Party, led by Mahmoud Abbas, seized control of the West Bank, leaving Gaza isolated and forsaken. In Washington, the Biden administration has voiced no protest against the terror group designations. The only government-level pushback has been a draft resolution signed on by a handful of House representatives. The draft resolution upholds the courageous work being done by the six Palestinian civil society organizations defending the human rights of a vulnerable and at-risk Palestinian population living under Israeli regime military occupation. But many more members of Congress on both sides of the political aisle signed on to a letter drafted by the Zionist regime lobby giant AIPAC, supporting the Trump administration's efforts to sabotage the International Criminal Court's probes into war crimes in Palestine and Afghanistan. These efforts included placing economic sanctions on Fatou Bensouda, the former chief prosecutor whose term ended in June, placing her in the company of international terrorists and drug traffickers. Though it has lifted the sanctions, the Biden administration has quietly attempted to pressure the Palestinian Authority into dropping the case at the International Criminal Court. Yet another green light to the Zionist regime to continue to build settlements in violation of international law and kill scores of Palestinians with U.S. weapons without consequence. The eagerness of the EU and UN bodies to defer to the Israeli regime is further indication that Palestinian human rights workers will be thrown to the wolves. The Zionist regime informed the EU embassy in Tel Aviv in advance of its intentions to designate Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations. The EU failed to relay this information to member states, some of which have pushed back against the Israeli regime's move. EU spokesperson Peter Stano told the electronic Intifada that we will be engaging Israeli authorities for more information regarding the basis for these designations. It is a statement of total deference to what human rights groups based in occupied territories have called an act of cowardice characteristic of repressive authoritarian regimes.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.